In the winter of 1667, Jean-Baptiste Denis performed several transfusions on Antoine Marois with calf's blood, who, after the third procedure, died. Marois' wife asserted that Denis was responsible, and Denis was charged with murder. He was acquitted, and Marois' wife was accused of causing his death. After the trial, Denis quit the practice of medicine. It was later determined that Marois actually died from arsenic poisoning. Denis' experiments with animal blood sparked a heated controversy in France, and in 1670 the procedure was banned there, and not until after Karl Landsteiner's discovery of the four blood groups in 1902 did blood transfusions become safe and reliable. The first blood transfusions were risky for everybody involved, as it turns out. What prompted Jean-Baptiste Denis to come up with the idea of transfusing animal blood into a human in the first place? And what bearing does his story have on the science of blood today? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How did those blood transfusions become the object of political infighting, professional backstabbing, and the struggle to control knowledge? Our guest is Holly Tucker, professor of French and medicine, health, and society at Vanderbilt University, and she's also the author of Blood Work, published in 2011 by W.W. Norton.
Welcome to University of the Year.
It's great to be here.
I see the subtitle of your book, Blood Work, is A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution. Tell us what drew you into the study of something that's kind of gory sounding, blood.
It is gory sounding. In fact, if you think that they were doing blood experiments on animals and humans before anesthesia and asepsis. It was quite gory. What got me into this topic, is that what you were asking? So I was getting ready to give a lecture on William Harvey's discovery of blood circulation, which took place in 1627. And I literally stumbled on this very odd case of interspecies transfusions and wanted to know more, and ended up staying up an entire night reading and reading and reading, and 5 years later, now there's the book.
Were the first transfusions animal to human? Isn't that kind of counterintuitive? Or I suppose you couldn't get a human to cooperate in that kind of thing.
Well, even though it seems that they were quite cavalier about human life by transfusing a human being with animal blood, it made sense. Why risk two lives when you would only risk one human life? And there were actually a couple other reasons that they reached first for animals. It's for millennia they had been using animal flesh and blood therapeutically, right, to balance and promote health. And it also makes sense. I don't know if you've ever seen a dog smoke or a cow swear. Is that it was considered, animal blood was considered to be more pure, actually, than human blood.
And I gather that that's one reason lamb's blood was sometimes used, to special ideas about lambs.
Absolutely. Lamb of God, blood of Christ, right? Nothing could really be more pure than lamb's blood.
Take us back to the 17th century, to the 1600s, and the concept of blood in general, what was understood about what blood was. I mean, we hear about how there used to be bloodletting, for example, as an approach to disease.
Well, that's what makes this story about the earliest blood transfusions so fascinating, because the idea of putting blood in to human veins was counterintuitive, because they had spent so many centuries taking blood out, right? How blood was understood in the 17th century, and it will continue on in many ways until the 19th century, it was part of a humoral system in which there were four humors in the body: blood, phlegm, black bile, and what they called yellow bile. And those were fluids that were imbued with different qualities. And if you took all of those humors together, you would have what was called a complexion, and that would be your state of health essentially. So that if any one of those humors were found in greater abundance than others in the body, you were out of balance and you needed to rebalance the body. And the fastest way to do that would be to do bloodletting or through purging or through enemas and laxatives, is to get the ill humors out of your body.
Those enemas very popular among the aristocracy in 17th century France, weren't they?
Oh, huge.
A big
in
fad.
Fact, literally, in fact, huge, because the enemas themselves could be up to 3 or 4 feet, and they looked a bit like, big tubes.
Why does it seem like a singularly French topic all of a sudden? But where did this idea first come from, our first transfusion on record?
Well, to tell that story, you have to back up to first how blood was thought to move through the body, because some radical changes happened that sparked people to look at blood differently. So if there was the system of humors, the humors were critical in how an understanding how blood was made. So first, blood was made through food. Everybody knows that. Is you eat, the blood gets turned around in the stomach. It's concocted in the stomach and moved to the liver, where it then moves to the heart. And the heart itself, blood didn't circulate in this period yet. It was felt that the heart was something of a furnace. So you breathe in and you stoke the fires of the heart. The blood burns. You breathe out and you blow off the fumes, right? So this was the predominant way of understanding blood. And then William Harvey came along and decided that blood circulated. And that was a radical idea.
And that was what? Was that 1628 or something like that?
Yeah, in the 1628.
And you mentioned the four humors, Holly. And if you had too much of one, it would throw you off balance. But how could you separate them?
Separate the humors? That's the trick. In fact, blood itself, it's not a discrete, as far as definable fluid, is the blood itself also had a variety. You could have some phlegm in there, you could have bile. It was really the body, and I say this with all respect, because at every time period, tried to struggle with models to understand our world and how we inhabit that world, is that for as simplistic as it seems now, it really made a lot of sense. The body was this mucky mess of fluids, and they all sort of intersected. And if you let blood, or if you purged, you would be purging, yes, blood, but so many other attributes that might be causing you illness.
So is the idea that if a person is out of balance with the humors, and if you take out a pint or two of all of their blood, they would somehow replace that with more pure blood.
Exactly. And that was a more efficient way to offset the imbalance, because you could do that nutritionally, but that would take a while. So you might as well, when I get a headache or when I have a fever, I reach for a Tylenol. It's the most efficient way, but in the 17th century, they would reach for bloodletting.
And how much would they tap typically?
Well, you can take a look. How would you measure it? 3 cups, maybe?
Three cups. So, I mean, if you can give a pint and not feel any particular effect for most people.
Right.
A couple of cookies and you're on your way.
Well, there are some stories. George Washington, for example, there's a question about whether George Washington died of an infection of the epiglottis and resulting problems, or whether he died from the copious bloodlettings that he got.
Could have
and sometimes
helped him
with
on his
leeches
way.
In certain areas, right? Weren't leeches used to suck blood out?
Absolutely. And in fact, in addition to working on blood work, my book, I not too long ago wrote an article for The New Scientist on modern medicinal uses of leeches.
Which are pretty prevalent. I mean, you can look at a hospital bill today and see a bill for leeches.
Well, and here's an interesting, there's always a French connection. we tracked the leeches that they use in trauma surgeries in the United States to one provider, and that provider is in France. And of all places in France, Bordeaux.
Is that true of maggots also?
Now, I don't know if there's a premier provider of maggots, but there is one company out of Bordeaux that ships all leeches to the United States.
What about in the past, before the understanding of circulation and transfusions and so on, if there was a very severe injury in the battlefield and someone was losing blood, mm-hmm. basically bleeding to death, mm-hmm. What was done to try to stop the blood loss?
At the 16th century saw the use of tourniquets for the first time. Ambroise Paré, a French battlefield surgeon, did some work with tourniquets. There were other, stopping bleeding to begin with. Paré did one of the first evidence-based, if you want to call it anachronistically, evidence-based studies in which he was trying to figure out the best way to heal gunshot wounds, whether it was best to pour boiling oil on them or to put healing salve.
And I vote for the second.
He did too. He did too. But it was very interesting as the recipe for the salve included whelps, young puppies. So there was rose oil and puppy stuff, which traumatizes my students in my history of medicine classes.
Traumatizes the puppy too, and maybe the patient as well.
They might not have realized what was in the healing salve.
And so when William Harvey was able to make his kind of deductions about circulation and see what really happens with the blood, what led him to make those advances, and how did that then lead into the transfusions?
Harvey's story is fascinating because he, like so many natural philosophers, as scientists were called in the 17th century, they were part of a legacy of the Renaissance, where sort of chucking old knowledge and wondering wanting to check it and make sure it was factual. So Harvey started questioning early understandings of blood as being non-circulating and being produced through the digestive system. His question first came from, why do we have valves in our veins? What's the function? And in the past, before Harvey, it was felt that the valves functioned as something of locks, like locks in a river, right, to stop all of the humors and fluids from pooling in the lower part of the body. And so he began doing dissections, and it felt quickly frustrated because you can't see much about the blood when you're working with dead animals and dead bodies. So he moved to small animals like rabbits, and was very frustrated because those heartbeats just go so fast. And then finally ended on cold-blooded creatures like snakes. And he could see as the snake was slipping towards death, the heart beating more slowly and the veins and arteries inflating and contracting. And he wondered then if something wasn't happening. So he did a very simple experiment in which he cut open the heart of an adult human, and measured the amount of blood in one chamber. I think it was like 2 ounces, multiplied that by the number of beats per, I think, a half hour, and ended up coming up with this obscene number of 41 pounds of blood or something that would have to be produced in any given half hour. And he said there's no way that the digestive system could be making that and burning that off. And from there, he came to circulation. Now, that was revolutionary because now people had new ways of looking at the blood.
It caught on pretty quickly, obviously, if we're already doing transfusions in France, and those would obviously be based on the idea of circulation.
It actually didn't catch on as quickly as you think. In England, yes, absolutely. They claimed Harvey as their own and dove headlong into infusion trials where they could test Harvey's notion of circulation by infusing water, milk, beer, wine, opium.
I would think dye would be the easiest thing to
track. To see where it traveled.
Interestingly enough that you say that is that they, at the same time that they were doing infusion studies, they were using infusion eventually to look at how blood moves or doesn't move in the brain.
Because that's ambitious.
And this time period is also the rise of early neurology and neurological anatomy, because they hadn't really spent a lot of time studying the brain before that. And so Christopher Wren, who's the beloved architect of London, was doing these infusion trials, and he was working with Thomas Willis, who is considered in many ways the father of early brain studies, and looking at what was happening in the brain. So that's absolutely the case.
Seems it would be hard to do those kinds of experiments on living people.
They weren't doing them they weren't doing on living people. They were doing them on animals, living animals. This is also the time period of the rise of vivisection and in vivo experiments.
Controversy involving this kind of vivisection and experiments on living humans?
You know, the chapters on the dog experiments were really hard to write because they are hard. The case reports are very detailed and very hard to read. And, you know, there are a couple of camps of thought. Some people have a tendency to look at these scientists of the 17th century as these cold-hearted beasts that delighted in ripping apart animals for the sake of knowledge. And what I ended up finding is that's not entirely the case. Christopher Wren, actually, one of his last experiments was on a human. He was injecting the human with an emetic and with very bad results. In fact, they were very worried that there was a servant of a nobleman. They were very worried that the servant was going to die. And that seemed to rattle Wren. And he shortly after started moving more towards his architectural studies and other inventions. And even Robert Hooke. Now, Hooke did these extraordinary hook and Boyle where they were putting, you know, animals in air pumps.
Hooke and Boyle are not the names of people I would want to be in an experiment with.
Tell me why.
Well, the names, just to...
Hooke.
It's not like Dr. Bledsoe, you know. It's just not somebody you want to deal with. But Hooke and Boyle were really instrumental in these experiments as we get toward the end of the 17th century.
Absolutely. But, you know, they were studying vacuums and they were putting small animals in vacuums. But even Robert Hooke, he did this horrific surgery with a bellows. He inserted bellows in the trachea of a dog and they were trying to basically put the dog on a ventilator. And in his writings, he expresses grief. And it takes time away, actually, from animal experiments. You know, this is where they're trying to balance this unbelievable need to know and to learn and to uncover the truths of the natural world and at the same time come to terms with the great emotional expense.
Were they doing transfusions then in England at this point, mid-17th century?
No, not yet. They were still – so if William Harvey is in 1628, the infusion experiments were in the 1650s, and they begin doing transfusion experiments in 1665.
So let me just clarify. So an infusion would be if you put in coffee or wine or something, but the transfusion would be species to – or, you know, a person to a person or animal to person.
Or interspecies, exactly. Exactly. So there's a really clean progression in going from circulation infusion to transfusion. And transfusion is essentially where things got very thorny.
And we're going to cross the channel into France for those first transfusions when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Holly Tucker, who is telling us about the early experiments in transfusion of blood in the 17th century and really how it affected the scientific attitudes and politics of the times. And we have Harvey in England determining that blood circulates, the heart pumps it, it moves through the veins. Did that idea catch on overseas in France in particular?
No. Keep in mind is that the English are Protestants, and they have a long tradition of pushing back against tradition. So something like circulation is part and parcel of what becomes a national sport in a way is questioning. The French, however, have spent the same amount of time pushing back against those who would push against tradition. Right. And the whole idea of circulation was scandalous. In fact, in many ways, sacrilege.
Because
sacrilege in the sense, I guess, tradition, tradition becomes something of a religion in France, if you will, is that the ancient doctors, Galen, Hippocrates, had all of the truths, right? And so anybody who would go against those truths was scorned as a rebel rouser. So the French Academy of Medicine, based at the University of Paris, they spent a lot of time doing these unbelievably convoluted theses about does blood circulate? No. Is it not possible that blood does not circulate? Yes. You know, all done in
logical terms.
In very ornamented Latin. And the transfusionist who ends up doing these main experiments is not trained in Paris. He is not part of the medical elite. He's actually training in Montpellier, which is a rival medical school in the south of France. There are more Protestant students in that school. It's the school where, according, you know, we all have our rival teams, right? It's a school where dummies go, where they spend all of their time talking about the meaning of life and drinking and cavorting with, in 17th century, that's what rival schools do, cavorting with prostitutes. And you have this, you know, upstart physician who's not part of the medical elite coming to Paris, believing absolutely in circulation and wanting to replicate some of these early transfusion trials.
So this is sort of a rogue physician, this Mr. Denis?
Absolutely. He is a renegade physician. In fact, I admire him in many ways because he's not of a high birth. His father was an artisan. He is takes his training at a school that would not let him in. Right. And he decides that, you know, all of these roadblocks are in front of me, but I really want to practice medicine in Paris and I want to make a name for myself. But then at the same time, I find him frightening because of what he's willing to do. Now, he couldn't have been aware at the time that Louis XIV's Royal Academy of Sciences had been asked to perform experiments on transfusion as a way to test what the English were doing. Because we're at this moment, it's for all practical purposes, it's like the early equivalent of the space race, is that the English and the French are locked in a battle for scientific dominance. And this dominance, this quest for dominance, is linked to nationalism, this heavy sense of nationalism. So Louis XIV's Academy of Science starts doing secret transfusion trials, canine to canine. And in fact, the records exist only in manuscript form. And I had to go to France and spend a lot of time in the archives of the Academy of Sciences to take a look at exactly what was happening. And they're being done by highly traditional doctors who are against transfusion, who at once don't want to see them work.
Which right away is a scientific handicap, is it not?
Well, I can read it actually in the manuscript, is that they don't want it to work because they want to prove the English liars. But at the same time, that even in these early years of the scientific revolution, it's counterintuitive. You really want your science to work at the same time, right? So their experiments failed. But the English ones didn't.
Failed in terms of the dogs dying? Or?
They died at a greater rate than the English experiments. And for the longest time, I couldn't figure out why that was the case, because they were pretty much replicating the English experiments at the beginning. And it turned out, as I started to dig through the manuscript records, that they were reusing their dogs.
Reusing
their dogs. So the type of reaction, a blood incompatibility reaction that you will get depends on three things: the amount of blood that goes in, how fast, and whether there's been previous exposure. Now, we don't know how much blood actually went into the subjects in these early experiments. Probably not a lot, because they don't know anything about coagulation yet. They're using goose quills in the early experiments, so already things are sticking inside those goose quills. But then when you do add that third variable, where you've already transfused one dog into another and then you retransfuse the same dog into the same recipient, you're going to get a much stronger reaction. And so that's why their experiments failed.
And so how does Monsieur Denis fit into the picture?
Oh, well, he didn't know that this was happening, but not long after, he begins his own canine-to-canine transfusion experiments, and they work.
Now, when you say they worked, does that mean the dogs survived?
One of the dogs survived. They would usually bleed the donor out to death. Denis didn't do that, so he had both his donor and his recipient dogs didn't die at the, you know, there's death. There's a lot of death, but it's the rate of death, and it's the rate of mortality that
so,
we're looking at.
So in order to empty one dog out, you're saying bled it to death, mm-hmm. into the other dog?
They would have a bleeding bowl next to the dog, and so they would both bleed the dog out into the recipient. They would bleed the recipient because you need to get rid of the blood that you were then going to replace.
You can only get so much in there.
And typically they would just try to push as much blood into the recipient dog as possible. And there's only so much blood you can lose before you slip into death.
And did they have a purpose in mind in doing this in terms of, you know, knowing that it would be handy to be able to give a transfusion to a person who had lost blood? I mean, did they have sort of a specific goal in mind?
That idea of replacing blood through transfusion is something that doesn't happen until the 19th century.
So they're just doing it out of curiosity to see if you can take two members of a species and transfer their blood.
Well, at the beginning they were dog to dog experiments, and Denis, that's the next step. So he first does these privately. And then he takes the show on the road. For anybody who's been in Paris, you can imagine the banks of the Seine. He was doing public transfusions of dogs. And he announced far and wide that next week, Sunday at, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm going to transfuse the blood of a healthy dog into a mangy dog, into a sick mangy dog, and watch the transformation. So it's almost a bit of a circus show that's happening.
With the expectation that the mangy dog would sort of...
Would be pepped up. Would be pepped up.
Is he charging admission for this?
No. These types of public experiments were not unheard of. There were public dissections that happened on a semi-regular basis in the King's Garden, for example, also on the banks of the Seine. So, no, it's not unheard of. And you know, bodies are public. Bloodletting was public. You had itinerant barber surgeons who would go from town to town and in the town square do bleedings.
Well,
or
that's true. I mean, executions
pullings.
Were public too. So
right.
All those kind of, I guess, life phases had a public aspect to them.
But the juxtaposition couldn't be bigger, right? As you have the French Academy of Science locked away in the stately King's Library doing these transfusions and doing them in a very top secret way. And then you have this rebel-rousing renegade physician on the banks of the Seine doing extraordinarily public things.
Now, was he successful enough then, you're saying, Holly, with dog-to-dog transfusions that he felt he could make that jump to interspecies transfusions?
Absolutely. He tried several things first, a round robin of transfusions where he had dog A transfusing into dog B transfusing into dog C into A, right?
A circle.
Yeah,
a dog
exactly.
Circle.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then he started to move to the next logical step, which is human transfusion.
On your website, you have this section called 12 Surprising Things You Didn't Know About Blood Transfusions, and it included a fact about the Roman time that spectators would rush into the arena to try to take the blood of fallen gladiators for their own strength. So in some of these mangy dog to healthy dog transfusions, is there this idea, do you think, that if we found a way to get somebody else's blood, we could find somebody who is stronger, who is better, who is nobler? You know, that whole business about the nobility having different blood. Is part of it this concept that we're going to be looking for, I don't know, some preferable blood that we want to
well,
have
even in England, as they hone in on these canine transfusions, they start to wonder if transfusion wouldn't be helpful for intravenous feeding. And I think that is very interesting.
I mean, for people who literally cannot eat and
exactly,
so get something
right.
directly into the blood.
Exactly.
Well, that's fairly modern thinking.
And the transfusions themselves, as far as, you know, can we change the quality of the recipient in some way by transfusing blood? In this case, it would all be of animals, blood of an animal or something. The transfusionists themselves in England are excited about that possibility, in that Robert Boyle actually in 1666, puts together for all practical purposes a research agenda of close to 25 questions in which he asks that question, can you feed someone intravenously? What if we took the blood of a feathered species and moved it into a furry dog?
Sounds
would we
like
get
a
something?
Mythological creature.
Mm-hmm. And then at the end, he comes out and says that, is I wonder if by transfusing the blood of one species into another species, something of a metamorphosis may take place. And he says, I don't think that's going to happen, quite honestly. But we can't prove the point without experiments.
Well, by the time we get to Mr. Denny, and he's going from one species to another,
mm-hmm.
cow to human, mm-hmm. was he aware of the speculation that he might create a hybrid?
He didn't seem to be all that concerned about that. Because Denny, it was also a Cartesian, which he, Descartes, Rene Descartes, I think, therefore I am. Descartes had put forth in earlier in the century is that, and this helps explain a lot too of why they were reaching for animal blood, in addition to the fact that dogs don't smoke, is that human and animal bodies in Descartes' philosophy were understood as being pretty much identical machines, right? The only difference in Descartes' mind between animals and humans is that humans have the capacity for speech, for reason, and they have a soul. So where is that capacity? Where are those attributes? Descartes says it's not in the body because bodies are only machines. And this is the time period where they're coming up with hydraulics and they're very interested in machines. So all that makes us human is actually not corporeal. So Denis is pretty much looking at blood at this point as like changing your oil in the car, right?
Right.
But others in France around him can't stand Descartes either. They don't like Harvey. They don't like Descartes. Descartes was actually in exile in Holland. What if Descartes was wrong? What if there are attributes, as you were getting to, Emily, is what if there are attributes in the blood that could be transfused across beings? Could we then be creating these hybrid species? Could we have dog-headed men? Could we have humans that bark? And that was a frightening prospect to many, many of the more Catholic French.
I suppose there must have been some speculation, too, whenever they saw a deformed infant, you know, as to whether mm-hmm. there had been some kind of impurities in the blood history.
Not necessarily the blood history, but in fact, it sounds very problematic to say this now, is that many, many times a child with birth anomalies, depending on the severity of it, would be coded in terms of monster. They would actually call these children monsters because they could not make sense of a child with an extra limb or a cleft palate. As well, this is the time period where they're going out into the new world and they're traveling and they're, you know, the Europeans are seeing exotic animals for the first time, exotic peoples for the first time, and they're coming back with stories of monsters and sea monsters and extraordinary things. So the idea that hybrid creatures lurked around the world was not something new. In fact, it had long fascinated mm-hmm. the early period. The difference is that now science looked like it had the ability to engineer those species.
You write your book as a narrative, you know, mm-hmm. and rather than sort of as a, I don't know, It doesn't, on some parts, sound like the traditional nonfiction collection of facts. It reads like a story.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, from your book, read a description of one of the experiments?
Absolutely. Why don't we just take the main experiment that caused so much of controversy in the 17th century and that also led to the end of transfusions? So this is when Jean-Baptiste Denis was beginning his first transfusion of Antoine Mauroy. And he is at the home of the nobleman Henri Momor, who is his benefactor. And Momor has an interest in all of this because he's very frustrated that Louis XIV has established the Academy of Sciences and taken all of his scientists with him. And he really also, like Denis, wants transfusions to make a splash. In the center of the room, the surgeon Paul Emery was emptying his wooden toolbox and carefully placing his surgical instruments on a nearby buffet. knives and scalpels crusted with blood, clamps of various sorts, scissors, thread, muslin drop cloth stained rust brown, and several large bleeding bowls. Just steps away, a local butcher was straining to lift a young calf to the large central table with the help of Mom Moore's stableman. Moaning, the animal struggled until it was subdued by blows, the men working quickly to restrain the calf on its side. Then, as if on cue, there were loud shouts, and the room's heavy wooden doors flew open as several watchmen dragged in an unwilling and clearly deranged Antoine Marois. The dirty and unshaven man continued to resist, leaving marks from his bare and callous feet on the cold stone floor as he struggled. The butcher and his team quickly finished their work on the calf and rushed to help shove the screeching Marois in a chair. A few quick loops of a rope followed by a tight tug, Marois, like a tamed animal, now had no choice but to submit to the gruesome experiment soon to come.
So Denis is not exactly what we'd call a philanthropist.
No. In fact, the surgeon and the nobleman who was financing Denis's experiments, they plotted actually to pretty much grab the man off the street, drag him in, and tied him down. And
this was a deranged man, you said. Mm-hmm. But is it known what kind of mental illness
it's had? No, we're not sure.
Scared to death.
But the story is very fascinating, in fact. He is a peasant who came to Paris and became a valet for one of the most illustrious noble women in Paris. In fact, she was the doyenne of the literary world, Madame de Sévigné. In fact, anybody who studies early French knows all about Madame de Sévigné. And from what I was able to piece together in different reports is that Marois had fallen in love with one of the ladies-in-waiting, thought that he had a real chance at love. She ended up marrying somebody appropriate for her standing, and that was enough to take him over the edge. He ran through the streets of Paris screaming, set Madame de Sévigné's home on fire, and then spent much of the remaining days wandering aimlessly through the most illustrious part of town, the Marais, half naked. And it was felt, actually, the transfusion was at once to get attention because he was beloved and people felt sorry for him. He was also menacing. He loved to chase little children around the streets and also in the marshes of the banks of the Seine. But also there he wanted to perhaps cure the man and lock in his celebrity because it was felt that madness, mental illness, was the result of overheated blood, and the vapors would rise to the brain and trouble the mind. So if they transfused him with animal's blood, that would cool down his humors and perhaps temper the mental illness.
And he survived that first transfusion?
The first transfusion he did, the second one he did. Interestingly, his wife, also a peasant woman named Perrine, at the same time was looking for her husband desperately through the streets, and she had heard about the transfusion, knew it had to be her husband. There was only one mentally ill man in Paris to her mind, and she was ushered into this unbelievable estate, I mean, full of wealth, and you can only imagine what it must be for a peasant woman to see her husband now no longer screaming but quite calm. And we learn, actually, in this account that Perrine was suffering domestic abuse as well. And so she stammered to the transfusionist, Jean Denis, "You don't understand. I don't know what you've done to my husband. At this time of the year and with the moon being full, he would be beating me. And now he's telling me he loves me." Right. And it's a sad story.
How do we account for this transformation?
He was probably sick as a dog, all puns intended. He did have a transfusion reaction. You know, the room started spinning. His arms started getting warm. He was very sick. He vomited. He was just probably not feeling very well at all. And by the third transfusion, he was dead.
And we're going to follow that death in a moment when we continue with University of the Year.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Holly Tucker, and we're talking about her new book, Bloodwork, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution. We've just been talking about an early 17th century blood transfusion on a madman, who at first it seemed to work, but now we've got him dead. Mm-hmm. What happens then to the man in charge of the transfusion, Monsieur Denis?
So accusations started flying all over, is that Denis was responsible for the death. In fact, because he was a transfusionist, he was a murderer. It looked as if he would actually be taken to court on criminal charges. So what he decided to do is to do a runaround. He actually went to the criminal courts and made a countercomplaint. I'm being accused of murder. I did not do it. And you, criminal courts, you need to get to the bottom of the case. So a trial and an investigation went forward. And they brought in all different types of witnesses. You know, what was the patient's demeanor before you transfused him? What do you know about his health? And it came out, actually, that this third transfusion was not done in the home of the nobleman who was his benefactor, but rather the widow had seen such a wonderful change in her husband that she came to Denis' home, his personal home in Latin Quarter, and begged Denis to go back out to the country where her husband was now tied up and raving, saying, "You need to fix my husband again. I really liked what you did the first time." And Denis at first refused, and the widow became belligerent and said, "If you don't, you will be sorry." And so Denis and his partner, the surgeon, went out, and so the court case worked to reproduce essentially what had happened. And the story is very interesting. It turns out that the court said that Denis was not responsible, indeed, for the death, but that the widow was.
For having him do it? Having him do the transfusion?
For having poisoned her husband with arsenic.
Now, how did they track that down? How did that come out?
As far as I can piece together, investigators questioned neighbors, and the neighbors had said that there had been a lot of shouting and screaming at the house and that the wife had threatened to kill her husband if he beat her again, and that the neighbors, you know, all of this is suspect, right? We have to be careful, but the neighbors indicated that they'd seen the wife administer, I'm using my quote fingers, powders in her husband's soups, and that they had also tested the powders on a cat, and the cat had died. And from there, they said that the wife was responsible for murder by arsenic, and she was promptly thrown into the jails of one of the most horrible prisons in Paris, and we don't see a trace of her again.
And what? So Marois dead. She's killed him, not the transfusions. That's mm-hmm. the official finding.
Mm-hmm.
Case closed there.
No, not at all. Not at all. You can't make
Denis
this stuff
and not
up.
Not for transfusion.
The courts ruled that, yes, the patient had been murdered, not by Denis, but by the wife and by arsenic, and she had had help. And that help came in the form of three unnamed physicians. The court case does not name the physicians.
The plot does thicken.
It does. It does.
So they're out to sully the reputation of Denis.
Well, you know, what's interesting is when I first came across this, I knew that there had been a court case, and I knew that Denis had been exonerated of charges. I also knew that the courts took this as an opportunity to say that no future blood transfusions would be performed without the express consent of the Paris Faculty of Medicine. And we know that they don't like circulation. They don't like transfusion, so that's never going to happen. What surprised me is that there was that one line that said, and she had been helped by physicians. And historians who have looked at this, older historians in the 40s, just bypassed that entirely. And so I've spent the last 4 or 5 years trying to get to the bottom of who did it.
And did you go into it thinking it might be rivals of Denis?
I thought it was actually Claude Perot who led those Academy of Science trials, because his writings are unilaterally against not just transfusion, but he makes his thoughts clear on Denis. And so I went to the archives of the Academy of Sciences, second trip, to see what I could find about it. And I could not find anything on Perot. But I was very fortunate to have stumbled on a letter written by a lawyer at Parliament who said, what is happening to Jean-Baptiste Denis is scandalous, and those men who are responsible for the death of the madman should be ashamed of themselves, and here are their names.
Oh, how handy.
What had happened is I despaired. This is a long process to do a book like this that's at once narrative and also deeply researched.
You need an end.
Well, I didn't think I was going to be able to write the book. I'd made several trips to Paris. I'd been to London. I'd been to Rome. I knew there had been a murder. I'm not the guy I thought who did it and done it. And I truly, literally was stacking my research papers in a pile, and I had tons of them. And I had resolved I was going to go through them one by one and put them away and say, this book's done. I can't write it. And what happens when you do archival research, particularly abroad, is you have so much you have to see, but you don't have the time. So you spend a fortune in reproducing manuscripts, getting photography of manuscripts and printing out microfilm. And what had happened is during one of my trips to Paris, I'd done just that, as I'd ordered up a bunch of documents, including manuscripts and some Parliament records. And it takes like weeks for them to come. And they had arrived. And I just took them and put them in a pile and never looked at them. And so as I was packing up my research materials, I found a huge stack of documents. And there was the lawyer's letter. And then I spent another couple of trips abroad. And because, I was accusing people of murder. And whether they're dead or not, no matter how colorful they might be, you have to be ethical and responsible about this. So it was only several months later that I was sure I had them. And interestingly enough, once I had the names, these guys were lurking out there in plain sight.
Yeah. From the Academy?
I don't want to say.
You don't want to say?
I don't want to say.
To read your book.
But, vigilantes are rarely shy, right? Mm-hmm. And so their treatises and letters make it really clear that they had a hand in it and they weren't ashamed of it either.
Well, to step away from this particular case, which kind of took another turn into arsenic and mm-hmm. rivalry and murder, but to go back to more the controversy over should transfusions be done at all and, what kinds of conflict does that raise with religion and science and so on, what kind of modern relevance do you see to the study you did?
And how did the science of transfusion progress, for that matter, after something like this?
Well, those are two different questions. And I guess I'll start by saying when I knew – so I knew I had the murderers, but I also knew that I needed to write this book in a way that was accessible to a larger readership in 2006. And of all things, it was when I was watching George W. Bush give a State of the Union address in which he called for a ban on animal-human hybrids. And I thought, what in the world? Where is that coming from? And he was basing that on a 2004 President's Council on Bioethics report in which there was, again, another call for a congressional ban on animal-human embryonic stem cell research. And there was fear that, and I'm using my quote fingers because they do some renegade researchers could do untold damage to the human species. And I thought, my gosh, this sounds awfully familiar. And I watched the internet in the weeks to come and the newspapers, and the responses were very similar as, what? Of course we should not be doing this. The scientific response is, well, to be honest, as we do interspecies research a lot. It's varying degrees with varying yuck factors. Then there was another response is, I would really like to be a dog-headed man. And it occurred to me that in any time of scientific revolution, these responses are natural and normal in a way. So there is a real modern hook into this.
But somewhere along the line, somebody started doing transfusions that actually consistently worked How long did it take?
Well, they did. Transfusions didn't start back up for another 150 years. They began in 1818 in London. And in an obstetrics ward, James Blundell was seeing his patients hemorrhage to death, and he had remembered, it's a very quick reference, that there had been transfusions in the past. So he began first by injecting human blood into an animal, and the animal died. And that made him immediately decide not to do interspecies transfusions. And he did a small couple of handfuls of cases in which he transfused the blood of a husband into a wife or a hospital staff member into a new mother who had hemorrhaged substantially. The cases were not particularly successful, but they were successful enough, at least a few patients had lived, that physicians across the 19th century were trying all different ways to continue blood transfusion. It was only until 1901 with Karl Leinsteiner and blood group, blood type discovery that really started to speed forward in 1914 with the discovery of sodium citrate to keep blood from coagulating.
Right. That was had to be a really big breakthrough so that it would keep flowing and not
it
stop
was huge
up.
Because they were doing these transfusions with the patients hooked up to one another, right? And later they were actually stitching veins and arteries together. So now with sodium citrate, you could put the blood in flasks and administer it remotely. So that was a huge advance. And then the first blood banks were established. First one was in Leningrad, and the second one was in Cook County Hospital in Chicago in the 1930s. And then we sort of speed forward.
And what surprised you most about your study, you know, about the time period that you were investigating and as you looked into medicine in this time?
Well, I think every time I turned around, there was some new twist that I could not ever anticipate, that different personalities. And, you know, because I work in early history of medicine, I think that my level of surprise is probably lower than my students, which is really quite high. What surprised me, actually, was the modern story of blood. I did not know, for example, that blood was segregated by the Red Cross and other major blood services until the 1970s, actually.
By race, you mean?
By race. Mm-hmm. And those questions get to, you know, the heart of what I worked on in the book, too, is it's just not about the science of blood transfusion. It's really about how we understand humanness, right, and how we understand where I begin, where you start, and how comfortable I am about us intersecting in some way through blood. And whether that means, you know, intersecting species, intersecting races, it's all about getting to the heart of human identity.
Our guest has been Holly Tucker, author of Blood Work. Thanks for joining us and enlightening us about, I'm not going to say the wonderful world of transfusions, but the fascinating world of transfusions, especially in the early years in the 17th century. Thanks for being with us.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.